One, two, three, four. You are listening to KAOS 89.3 Olympia, Washington.
From KAOS 89.3 FM in Olympia and the Ruinous Media Network, I'm Mark Lee Morrison, and this is Low Profile, the podcast that stays at least 6 feet away from popular music. On today's show, I've got Jack Habegger and Dylan Shearer returning as co-hosts to have a conversation with one of our favorite living artists, Mayo Thompson. Mayo Thompson is the founding member of the Red Crayola, an experimental rock group from Houston that formed in 1966. Mayo went on to become a producer for influential albums by The Raincoats, Pear Ubu, Stiff Little Fingers, and plenty more. He also released a solo album, Corky's Debt to His Father, which still endures some 55 years after its recording. As of late, Mayo has formed an ensemble to perform Corky's Debt tracks as recorded for a live audience on a few rare occasions. He's also published two novels, first, Art Mystery, and then its sequel, Aftermath, both available from Drag City Publishing. Today we'll be talking about those books, as well as the Red Crayola's unconventional evolution, a long-standing collaborative relationship with the conceptual collective known as Art and Language, finding a mentor in Guy Clark during his youth, and his favorite hip-hop albums. We'll also be hearing a few selections from the Red Crayola's vast discography. We spoke with Mayo over the phone.
Where are you all? You're in on the West Coast?
Yeah, we're in Olympia, Washington.
Olympia, Washington, my goodness. How's the weather?
Very wet. Very wet indeed.
Congratulations.
Yeah. And you're in Los Angeles?
Yes, I am.
How's that going for you?
I like it here.
Good.
I've been here since 1996.
Oh, wow.
I was working at Art Center College of Design, so I just moved here. I had a job.
Are you still working in education?
No. I haven't done anything since 2000, maybe 6-7. I've been invited a few times to speak at the Mountain Art School. I've done that, but then I wouldn't call that educational.
I guess that explains how you've had time to write a couple novels.
I'm one of those people who has the good fortune to do what I want to do most of the time. And I worked regular to get here, and here I am. But no, that first book, Art Mystery, that was a long time in the process. I started writing that thing in late 1980s, and it went through lots and lots of variations and just so on. I didn't constantly work on it. I worked on it here and there. Sometimes I'd let it sit for a while and age, and then we try to figure out how to go on with it and so on like that. So there's also lots of stuff that has been gone. It was more about football. I killed somebody one time, maybe two times in there. Nobody had died in there anymore, except the poor person who volunteered their ashes. That's in the second book. It is not a leisure time activity with me. I really do. I have been writing for a long time, since I was in high school, is when I started writing things down on pieces of paper. And when the computer came along, I liked that and was able to keep things and keep track of stuff and files. So I got tons of stuff. But those books, I was able to finish the first one and then had an idea for the second one, finally.
Yeah.
Felt like I really owed it to these characters to try to wind it up somehow. So that's where the second book came from.
Clearly, a continuation of the story, same characters, but it's a very different book, I feel, stylistically, and I guess that explains it, that you wrote them in very different parts of your life.
No, let me be clear about Art Mystery. I didn't finish that version that came out 5 years ago by now, something like that.
Right.
No, I worked on that up to the last day I turned it into Drag City Books. that was quite polished, but it had quite a slightly different function. It was not, for one thing, it was a study in the problem and the question of, you know, iconicity and a few other sort of like quasi-academic concerns of mine that go back to my philosophical pretensions, which I've, in the long run, I'm that's a very different relationship to philosophy now. I see it quite differently. So things have changed. And the second book, it was easier. It was more like writing a romance novel about people who were trying to go on and get along and blah, blah, blah. And there was a bit of that in the first book as well, I thought.
There was. I think the main difference for me is that the first book had just such extensive photographic references and footnotes and a lot of just diving into different eras of art history and sculpture and religious art and all that.
The ideas in that book about how what was going to happen and so on. And the characters were all at the service of making this mechanism like work. And you get to the actually quoting Gombrich and from his book, and also using the book as a vehicle in terms of which to argue with him slightly about his take on a painting, which I rather like. And he's a very influential art historian. And a good one, of course. He was fabulous. I'm not. I studied it. But
you were, if I'm correct, you were studying art history and pursuing that before you ever wound up getting involved in music. Is that correct?
That is correct.
And it's just remained a passion.
I was in college when I was doing, but I was doing, involved in a writing program there and writing. I had a teacher and I was writing stuff, fiction. And when I started playing, I was playing music a bit at the same time. I was beginning to get going. 63 is when I started playing music professionally. I played in public. And then 66, I started playing for money.
Got it. What was your first group? Can you tell us anything about that?
I always make a joke about it. It was really not a group, but it was. I was in military school, and one of my classmates, a fellow guy from Houston as well, Stan Stanford, he was a trumpet player, and we liked to listen to rock and roll records in the dormitory, and we liked to some kind of music. We liked black rock and roll, and danced to it and all that sort of stuff. But one day we found ourselves in the music building. And we started jamming it. He hauled out a drum and started thumping on it and playing, blowing his trumpet, not pounding on the piano. And he shouted lyrics and stuff like that. That was our first experience as a kind of a band, yeah. When I was in college, I was in a comedy band with two fellas. And when my freshman year, a guy from Houston and a guy from Baltimore, and Bob Raines and Paul Norris. And we formed a kind of a comedy trio and sang funny songs, you know, like Buddha, 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 that kind of stuff. And Buddha got very mad at me about that. I think a little cross with me. And he's been like trying to teach me lessons ever since those days. But I have a sense of humor about it. I hope he does.
I think, it seems Buddha's got a sense of humor. And you got right in there with the rest of the Texas fried out rock scene that was happening.
We elbowed our way in a little bit. I think neither of us was what you would call, I don't know, gifted musicians. No, we were interested in mastery in that sense. Those instruments were instrumental to the electric. What we were going to have, what we could do with them, but we found eventually that we had a public. We were able to develop a position, and people had to take us seriously to some extent. And among the Houston psychedelic bands, and after the Elevators, we were the first of that crowd to record. And I think some of those people were a little shocked because they didn't think much of what we were doing.
It takes me where I want to go, doesn't matter whether or not it rains. If my hurricane or fighter plane I love. And it takes me where I want to go, to the sky above. To the sky above. Through the clouds of love. Well, this one thing, my baby, I know that I must do for you. And it's the only thing that I can do. It's my hurricane, oh, fighter plane, and it's mine. And it takes us through the sky all the time. All the time.
I think it's still shocking today that your debut album was just right out the gate, just completely alien to everything else that was happening at that time that I'm aware of.
We weren't trying to fit in. We actually had elimination pretensions and thought of ourselves liquidating those positions and thinking nobody would bother after this stuff, and unless they were really into repeating, which is fair enough, of course. But we also, we were thinking of a slightly destructive relationship conventions. I mean, Leland Rogers, he liked to say to the people they couldn't play a lick, but that he put him out anyway, which makes him look like some kind of like savant. And no, it's all fine. It's all business. It was a great deal of fun at the time. And it still is a kind of fun. Let's continue to play. I'm working with what I would call the Corky Band now, and we play in Corky's Dead to His Father music, and some selections from the Red Crayola songbook. So we still got my hand in.
You were talking about how you guys got some supporters early on and then brought them into the band, so to speak. The Familiar Ugly?
Yes.
Yeah, I heard about them bringing a motorcycle into the studio. One of the legends, and
let me try to explain.
Yeah, please.
Right, we started off as a five piece, so we were still students in the University of St. Thomas. I met Steve Cunningham, and he had a friend named Bonnie Emerson, and we knew this guy named Danny Shack. So we were a five piece to begin with. We played some stuff, people liked it. We got started playing in a club, which was started by a friend of Bonnie's. We were invited to be house band. We played there every night for a while. And working up our fresh material, trying to write our own tunes and stuff like that. And then we had some kind of reputation because KNUZ, a local top 40 radio station, had a battle of the bands, and we were invited. So we first gigs on the road. We got someone out and played two high schools out of Smiley and Channel View outside Houston, and one in the gymnasium and one on the stage with music instruments. One night after playing at Love, Mark Froman, we found, he got on stage, and so suddenly we were a six-piece, and it was like, Rick and Steve and I looked at each other and thought, this is not quite what we were thinking about. I was delegated to fire Bonnie and Danny and Mark, which I did, and Danny Shack made one of his most wonderful remarks. He was really a great character. He said, "It's okay, Mayo. Your music is ontologically unsound anyway." He was amazing, dude. I'd love to know what happened to him. But it happened that when we were a trio, then things slightly changed because some other people that we got to know, they just joined in. We didn't say, "Would you like to join?" And we just looked, and there they were. But they weren't part of the band exactly, so we didn't have to tell them anything because they weren't playing musical instruments. They were making noise and doing weird shit. Mike Medico would be, excuse my French, Mike Medico would build a tent inside of a tent, or have blow up furniture, or use a circle saw and cut a television to pieces. And he was an artist who would treat it as an opportunity to happen. And happenings were happening in those days. And so it was that kind of a thing. And then we played. Finally, we found out that we had made it to the finals of the band. And the finals were between us and the Johnny Winter Sextet. And they could play. And by the time we were doing that, we were freaking out and not playing songs in quite the usual sorts of ways. I would be standing there singing and playing the guitar and so on. That's something that was approximation of a song as we had them, because they were not everything was always finished. Hurricane we finished when we went to the studio later. But at the first battle of the bands, Leland Rogers heard us. And he worked for IA as an A&R guy. And he signed us to a deal. So we went in the studio, and we invited these people with whom Rick dubbed the Familiar Ugly to come along if they wanted to. and 50 of them showed up, or whatever it is. I can't say. There's a photograph of all of the people there, and some people have ridden that little event into history. There was a guy who was riding down the street and right outside Walt, and we were standing all around outside Walt Anderson's studio. Guy came riding down the street on a chopper, and he stopped and he said, "Hey, what are y'all doing here?" You know, like that. And we said, "Well, we're going to go in here and record a record." And he said, "I don't know what." And we said, "Hey, come to think of it, you want to bring your bike in, and it'll be on the record." And he said, he laughed, and went, "Hell yeah, come on then." So that it was that kind of thing. There's a photograph of all of those people in the recording room with that bike in the foreground with Leland Rogers sitting on it, I think. We had more fun than you're supposed to all the time. We had great public, and we had a really mixed public. We had weirdos and freaks, and we had two. There were two bikers from the Banditos who liked us a lot, and they would come to our shows. So we were safe as well, unlike the elevators who were persecuted.
Oh, yeah? They got a lot of flack?
They were made an example of, I think that's what they called it back in the day.
Oh, man. Rocky Erickson was on the Parable of Arable Land playing harmonica, right?
Harmonica and the keyboard. He played organ on Hurricane. Yeah, organ on Hurricane and Hurricanes, I'll pronounce it, is on the record. And mouth organ on Transparent Radiation. He came to the studio, and Leland brought him in there, and Tommy tried to explain and mediate, you know, and everything, and one just looked at him and said, "Dude, that'll be fine." And then we looked at Rocky, and Rocky, he was like happy as a mudlark, and put on the headphones and sat down at the keyboard and took two takes, listened to it once and played along, and listened to it again. That was it. Same thing with the Transparent Radiation. He was a deadly good musician, very good. And people really liked the Elevators. We made fun of them. We called their music elevator music. And the only people who knew what Muzak was understood the joke, right? We wanted to do concerts in funny places that we wanted to play in an elevator in their building. Instead of elevator music, you'd get in the elevator and then we'd be playing something. We had stupid ideas. It was fun.
Yeah, you got to try everything. Try what you can. I'd like to say, you mentioned the Corky Band happening now. So I reached out to some listeners, and a lot of them were very curious just to hear a little bit more about the background of your lone Mayo Thompson album.
I'm a student of human nature, and all my lessons I have learned for free. I held your little breast in my hand, and I kept my eyes on your knee. I was breathless when you crawled in the door, and gasped when you sat on my lap. Good-natured, I asked what you wanted, and understood when you drew me the map.
When the Crayola fell apart the second time after God Bless, Bartholomew had been in New York while we made God Bless. He was out of band after the first album. And then after Parable, then we recorded Coconut, but nothing happened with that. Then Bartholomew and I got together and in New York and tried to write some tunes and tried to do this and that and the other thing. And we finally wrote a couple of tunes and made a single. This old Tom Clark with under the name Saddle Sore. Old Tom Clark and Pig Ankle Strut on the B-side with Frank Davis singing both songs, right? That was one of the last things recorded at Walt Studio. And that sat on the Warner Brothers A&R desk for a couple of weeks while they tried to make up their mind whether or not they were going to sign Saddle Sore to make a record. But it never happened. So we gave up on that. Then Rick and I, we tried one more time. We got together a band called the Rocking Blue Diamonds, which had Rock Romano was singing because it was, it had been... But by that time, Corky had been finished, and Walt Andrus's partners heard that record, and they hated it. They said, we can't sell that. That's crap. Blah, 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 blah. Joe Dugan said, male's voice is an acquired taste, stuff like that. And so I stopped singing. But I had made Corky in the meantime, which also wasn't happening. And the way Corky got to be made was I knew Frank Davis, and I knew Rock. I wanted to do something, and I thought I'm going to make a record on my own.
Yeah.
So between Saddle Sore and the Rock and Blue Diamonds, I made Corky in there, I think. That's when it was, 69, 70. And it came out, did come out, but there were some sold on mail order. They pressed maybe 700-800 of them. Walt did, and he sold some on mail order. The rest of them sat on the shelf, I think. For the longest time, I don't know what happened to the stock. And then I think Walt had some business that he, where he owed Frank some G, and instead of giving him that, he gave him the tapes. And we finally were able to make a deal when Glass Records in England put it out. And then finally Drag City put it out, and people seemed to like it. Albert Dillon tells me, man, that's the record they'll remember you for. And I thought to myself, oh yeah, they still need me. They still bleed me when I'm 94.
And now you've been playing those songs live.
Yes, this band was put together because a guy named Sohrab Mohibi, who was out here in Los Angeles, and he was the assistant director of a gallery that CalArts has downtown in L.A. called the Red Cat. And he got in touch with me. The Red Quail were invited to be in the Whitney Biennial in 2012, I guess it was, something like that. And then as a result of that, I got invited to make a show because I also draw and paint and stuff like that. Been doing that for ages. So I got invited to do a show in New York by a lady named Carol Green, who has a gallery there. And one day she wrote me a note and said, there's the guy you should meet in L.A. His name is Sohrab Mohibi. So I let her know that I'd be happy to. And then Sohrab and I, somehow we got in touch with each other. He wanted me to put together a band to play, a Red Crayola band to play corrected slogans in the Red Cat Theater. Yeah. We put together a band, and I couldn't play the guitar because I had carpal tunnel operations on my hands some months before, and they were okay for a while. And then one morning I awakened and I couldn't even hold a knife in my hand to eat my breakfast. So I couldn't play guitar. So Watson was playing the guitar parts, and Billy Bowman was playing bass, and we did versions of the songs that are on corrected slogans. And the house was full, which was nice. And we started getting calls, people wanting to book us in shows and mentioning all the capitals of all the countries in Europe and that kind of stuff. And people were really interested in this band. People were interested in that, they liked that record, they liked that music. So we thought we had a future. This was 2019 was the show in New York. 2020 was the show here at the Hammer. And you know what happened in 2020? The Hammer came down, and that was the end of everything. Now, we played a show here the other night. We had some bookings that finally, we had some offers after 3 years. We tentatively let it be known we would try again, maybe. We got a show, and the joint was full.
That's fantastic. I wish I could have gone there.
I have a question about Corky's while we're on the subject. My question is that Corky's feels a little bit more of a reflection of Texas music and Texas music traditions than your work with Red Crayola. Was that part of the concept to make an album that was more based in the Texas songwriting tradition?
No, I was just writing ideas that I had. And I was, of course, exposed to music, and perhaps there was some subliminal or some unconscious being. And when I say subliminal, perhaps I was sublimating. And certainly I would be working away from things. I wouldn't want people to associate me with this, that, or the other thing. I've always been like that. Mm-hmm. So far, I've managed. No fascists have rolled up and said, boy, I really like your music. I'm happy about that. And I don't like no fascists. And so I was careful, and probably there is some kind of relationship to that stuff, but I was not trying to cover any of it. People have characterized it as having a country feel sometimes, and there's, I suppose, you can take the boy out of the country, but you can't take the country out of the boy. Mm. The music I was mostly into, I was listening to blues records and jazz.
You know, I wanted to ask a question, just, and I don't mean to jump around, but I've always been curious about the process for Coconut Hotel, and or just how that came about, and what the thing was behind that.
Hotel was our second album, yeah. And we had decided that we were just going to do something completely different. I mean, when we signed the IA, they wanted us to cover that song, you know, Gentle on My Mind. Mm. We said no, right? And they couldn't make us. And also, at those days, it was such that, thanks to the Beatles and the Stones and a lot of things that were going on in the world, Dylan, Nontrip, all of those folky artists like John Prine, when people writing their own material, and they were making money. Kids were listening to what they were saying, and A&R guys and record companies were no longer telling them what they had to record. That was going on some places for sure, but not always everywhere. Certainly not where we were. I never had any luck telling me what to do. Mm-hmm. And so they just gave up trying. And so we went back to Walt Anderson's studio again, and we decided we wanted to make a stereo record. We didn't want to make mono, which we had done on Parable. Mm-hmm. We set up two microphones, and we had stereo in the studio, and we improvised. We just made pieces. Walt had, he had a Steinway grand. He had an electric harpsichord. He had like a pump organ. He had an electric, had a Hammond B2. He had some other kind of keyboard, some synthesizer, early synthesizer keyboards, all kinds of stuff. So we just used, so we got all of those going. That's that keyboard piece. Bartleby torturing the harpsichord. And very interestingly, and dynamically and stuff, and just improvising, and then making the water pour piece, pouring some water in a bucket and having a and playing a koto. But we had, they decided we shouldn't sing on the second record. There would be no singing. So I managed to skip two lines onto that record. There is no reason why not. And this is a commentary on what was going on and from within. And Frank Davis did this vocal, the main vocal. He put some headphones on, but not over his ears. He put one over his mouth, and the other was over the back of his head. And he went into him, and, you know, and at the same time had a practice amp holding it and swinging it around in the space, because it was understood how stereo worked. And, you know, like when you walk up to the microphone, even if you don't make a sound, you make that presence. They're all really dynamic sound experiments, playing the studio. That was what was happening. So then a guy named Kurt Von Meyer, he heard that music, and he said, if you were invited to the Berklee Folk Festival, would you play this music? Would you play some of that? And we said, sure, that's what we do in these days. And so he got us invited. But by the time we got to the Berklee Folk Festival, we were playing what they now call noise music and feedback on no vocals.
And you'd mentioned the first record you did with Art and Language. You continued working with Art and Language over the years, and it seems to be about half of your body of work is collaborations with them. What is Art and Language, and what is your relationship?
I've always had a relationship to visual art as well, and I've always socialized more in visual art than in music circles. Partly because, like in music, you don't see, unless there's a hangout, you don't see people. Mm-hmm. And or run into people on the road, that kind of stuff. And artists tend to go to certain kinds of bars and drink and blah, blah, blah. And they also do various things. And anyway, I knew a lot of artists. You know, Britt was an artist himself who painted. And we knew all the artists and painters in Houston. And when he moved to New York, he was involved in conceptual art. in the very beginning of it, and showing in the museum, showing in museums and showing in the galleries, one thing or another. And through him, I got to know Christine Kozlov and Joseph Kosuth and various other people, Larry Wainer, these people who were the part of the conceptual art movement. And amongst them, there was also this group in England called Art and Language. After recording Corky, it wasn't pressed right away. It was in 69 when I recorded it. We recorded, I should say. And then I went to England, and there I met Christine Kozlov, who was also, she knew Rick. She knew Art and Language, and that's through her I got to know who Art and Language. I got to know Art and Language. I got to read the journal and got to hear about them and so on like that. Didn't meet them at the time because I was doing other things in England. And then we got back to New York. At one point, I was in 70, I guess it was, finally, 70, 71, I moved to New York and got away from Houston and started working there and being around, trying to work, I should say, and got to meet some various people. Anyway, one day, Art and Language were in town to meet some people who were also calling themselves Art and Language, and some of them were, like Mel Ramsden and Ian Byrne. And Mel was an Englishman, is an Englishman, and Ian was an Australian. I mean, Art and Language is quite an international group, right? Big organization. Not quite organized, group of people, conversation, wide-ranging. Anyway, two of the English group who started this thing, Michael Baldwin and Philip Pilkington, came to New York for a conference because there was some strife between New York and England over what was being claimed with the name Art and Language under it. And people, it was a conference that was really interesting. It was called the conference about blurting. It was called Blurting in Art and Language, and they even published some stuff about it. It was quite interesting stuff. And what they were doing was tackling the problem of being interested in art as an idea and trying to do something about it, art as a pursuit, trying to do something coherent where there is with something that has no definite ontology. There's nothing on earth that necessarily makes anything a work of art except a mental representation. Language knew that. A lot of the conceptual artists weren't thinking along those lines. They were making art objects and stuff like the artworks. So there was some argument about some discourse in art, which I always found fascinating, these kinds of things. And I was drifted. At first, those guys, the guys in New York, they wouldn't talk to me because I was just seeing some guy from Texas, the Christine, right? Maybe, I'm not even sure they knew I was a musician. Until I talked to these two guys from England, because we got talking about stuff. They're like, what do you do? I said, I play this music. I just finished a solo album, blah, blah, blah. And they said, oh, yeah, well, what is a solo? I said, yeah, it's personal stuff. And he said, y'all got any ideas for lyrics? I said, write some lyrics. I said, I can put it to anything. I can put the goddamn phone book to music if you want to. Pick the town. And the letter of the, and we'll get started, you know, like that, they're joking with it, blah, blah, blah. So anyway, they went back to England after this conference broke up. And sure enough, a couple of months later, I got three lyrics from them. First, one of them was Ergastulum, one of them was Mistakes of Trotsky, and another was called Rational Horses, which was a song about Northern Ireland, which I still have not done. But I thought, wow, God damn, this is good stuff, right? So I set about putting Ergastulum to music. And what the first part is, quotes Elvis, I want to be free like a bird in a tree. And there's a discussion about like how you, to increase your income out of nothing, you've got to have privacy at home, detachment. I want to be free like a bird in a tree. My viewpoint is sociological and historical. I want to be free like a bird in a tree, three times riper in the USA. What is that shift, right? That's a fantastic shift for me. I never encountered lyrically work like that before, right? Or anything that was presented as a possibility for a lyric, to be a lyric, because they're not lyricists by trade, although they have gotten to be very adept lyricists over the time. I mean, it's like working with Shakespeare, dude. They're fun to work with. And I love their language. What they insist on is the existence of art depends on mental representation, and mental representation involves language, and that in order to get something up to the status of a work of art, you've got to work it up, and the way that you work it up is by addressing it in language.
My viewpoint is sociological and historical. I want to be free, free like a bird in a tree. Three times right par in the USA. Three times right par in the USA is a ridiculous idea. Materiering conditions of change derange, objective contradictions, independent contradictions can't grow.
And they were investigating the various languages and their applications with relation to making something an art object. And therefore, finally also got into the problem of lacunae, because what people think in England about it isn't different from what people who are artists in New York are thinking about it and so on. So I continued to collaborate as well.
Speaking of collaboration, I want to ask you about Pere Ubu, and specifically how a version of Horses, originally found on Corky's, ended up on the Art of Walking album.
That was David Thomas's idea. He wanted Pere Ubu to cover that song. And the arrangement is Pere Ubu's arrangement. I do not hold with it. It's Pere Ubu. And even though I participated in it, like, that's me covering my song with them.
Yeah. Hmm.
It's a cover version, right? It's not Horses.
Right, okay.
Yeah, I mean, various people have tried to cover tunes. There are various covers of Victory Garden out there. There are covers of Hurricane. There are King Stainless Tale, practically note for note cover of it. The thing about the Corky Band also that I want to point out is that these people are playing those tunes as written.
Listening to Low Profile, I'm Mark Lee Morrison. Mayo Thompson of the Red Crayola is today's guest, speaking with Jack Habegger, Dylan Shearer, and myself. If you enjoyed this episode and you'd like to hear the full unedited interview, you can find a link to it on this episode's website at lowprofilepodcast.com. Back to the show.
The kinds of sonic adventure experiments that they were in the first place, they reproduce those effects. Sonically, that band can do that. This band can do that, I should say.
So is that more rewarding than working with someone like Pere Ubu that does their own arrangement?
No, it's just a different game. I've never been able to play this game where you're actually playing the goddamn thing as written. Mostly, you turn around to a bunch of people and say, okay, Hurricane fighter plane in 3, 1, 2, 3, and people play what they think it is. In this case, we've actually bothered to learn. There would be rehearsals and people would learn. The Red Crayola, there have only been a few times when the Red Crayola was invited to play and it didn't really know what it was going to. Nobody knew what was going to happen until we started doing it. There have been a few of those as well, but by gosh, those are fun too. The art and language thing is also continues. I mean, that's my generation. Those guys are, you know, born in the 40s too. The slogans, I love that record, not least because those people were so brave as to start to raise their voices in song when asked to, and joined in, and we tried to make a communal fist of it, and did. I think some wild, wonderful stuff on there.
How did that experience differ from the record Kangaroo?
The difference between Kangaroo and the correct slogans is like the difference between Lou Reed with Velvet Underground and Lou Reed with the Berlin album. He's got hold of some musicians who could play.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm being a bit harsh, reductive, and sarcastic, but it's something like that.
Yeah,
I was really interested in the relationship with Laura Logic. To that record in particular.
Yeah, she was an X-ray Specs, and she and Polly Styrene had just, like, they were arguing when I first met her. She was 16, and she could play like hell. I played in her band for a while when I lived in England. I tried, and there I was learning guitar parts that had been written by somebody else, right?
With Essential Logic?
Yeah. I was guitar player for a couple of shows in that band. There was a kind of moment where I said, listen, I can't go on with this and shit. She perfectly well understood. And somebody else just came in and took the place. And sat in perfectly. She's wonderful. And on Kangaroo, what you find is Old Man's Dream. That's Gina Birch from the Raincoats. And Milkmaid, that's Laura. And Kangaroo did business. That was released in Japan. And that was a rough trade. That was when Rough Trade was really ascending. I think we sold some 25,000, 30,000 copies of that record, and which is not bad for an alternative indie scene record.
With all of your production work, did you have a production philosophy that you applied to every album, or did you tailor your approach to each group?
There are only a few occasions where, you know, like I very seldom was moved to say, hey, what about so-and-so? Steve Albini's philosophy, you know, when we were mixing the Red Crayola, the eponymous album, he mixed that. You know, it was recorded by his associate, and he mixed it. And I had to ask him, Steve, can I please leave your name off the record? He said, sure, go ahead. People do that to me all the time. And so at one point I said to him, how about some reverb there? And he said, Mayo, it's your record, and you can ruin it if you want to. So that's how that stuff goes. And I take advice. I'm not so proud that I won't hear what people think. I want to hear that. That's why I do anything.
So what was it like working with The Fall in particular?
Terrific band. Great people. Got along fine with Mark. Got along fine with all of them as well. The left-handed guitar player. Anyway, they were fun to work with. And they had ideas too. And it's so obvious. And of all of the punk vocalists, Mark, I mean, with that voice and also with that literary edge on his lyric and his, like, a high class beat poet 20 years out of time or 30 years out of time, and amazing stuff. The last time I saw Mark, he said, man, the best thing you ever did as a producer was keep Jeff Travis off the desk. he was a joker. The first time I ever saw The Fall was one of those kind of like Panglossian nights in London. They had a theater on the Strand somewhere. And The Fall opened and the Buzzcocks played and the so-and-so played. And like in three or four bands, punk bands, well-known punk bands played. But somebody threw a bucket of water on him. He'd have been killed by the microphone, but fortunately he didn't. But he played and sang and his voice, I mean, he also had people by the short and curlies all the time. He knew exactly what those people were thinking.
Are you digging on any contemporary music in particular?
With the time things catch my ear, I love Dr. Dre and Snoop Doggy Dogg. That stuff just cheered me up. Outkast, liked them very much.
I had a feeling you might be a hip-hop guy. I don't know what would give me that impression, but...
And those people, that's language, is wow, the use of language. Yeah. And stunning. I mean, I just really like it. It comes from, and it's like Calypso, too, you know, where the lyrics are made up on the fly and they're about something that's in your face, it's in your life. I like that.
Yeah. Are you still interested in producing for others?
If the time is right and the price is right, I can be talked to. I'm in business still. And I don't mean to be crude about it, but I saw 50 Cent the other day. I like 50 Cent, and people say, you're a businessman. He said, that's not quite right. I am the business, man.
We'll have to let Snoop Dogg know that if he's looking for a producer for his next record, that we've got your number.
No, dude, he knows what he knows where it's at. I liked Eminem's records until he went solo and didn't make that record. The last record he didn't have Dre on there. And Dre is understood how to mediate that stuff properly, and for the idiomatic relations, and for the groove thing, and for the right feel. And it's an interesting record, but it's not as good as the other ones, so to speak. When I say as good, I'm being presumptuous, of course. And my mind may change. You know, I might find it finally the best of all of them. I don't know. But that's my thought at the moment. And other music, I don't know. I'm a big Willie Nelson fan.
There's that Texas coming out.
I was at the first Dripping Springs reunion when he was still wearing alpaca sweaters and a golf cap before the outlaw took over, and heard Waylon Jennings and heard all of that stuff. I also like some of that stuff as well. I can't do it, but I like it. Guy Clark was an early mentor of mine.
I was exclaiming in surprise. I love Guy Clark.
Guy Clark, he's a real stone character. And I remember the night Guy was hanging, and he had to go and take his draft physical the next morning. And he failed it. We spent the evening together before he had to go. And yeah, he was a wonderful dude. He and Frank Davis were the guys who were, they were largely responsible for my being, and for getting a sense of, yeah, this is some place that you can show up, and even if you don't know nothing, you can sit down and learn. And that's what I did. I went to the music business and sat down and I started learning, and learned at the Jester, and that's where I met Guy.
I have another listener question to throw your way from Larry Joe Smith. He says, I'm curious about Mayo's creative working relationship with Jim O'Rourke. I really enjoyed the dynamic of the iteration of the Red Crayola from the 90s. And I guess the question here is, any memorable moments from then?
Nothing but.
Yeah.
Jim O'Rourke is a dear man. And over the time that we've gotten worked and known each other, we've gotten to be friendly, very friendly.
He does not eat just animals. A humanitarian, he likes a piece of flesh, fresh from the heart. We see cannibalism as primitive, uncivilized behavior. It violates the very things we stand for.
Now he's in Japan. I heard this about that. I can ask him, would you please contribute to this, that, and the other thing? And he'll do that. He'll always have a go. And it took me a while to get the drift of just how bright he is and how smart he is about what he does, about what he contributes to the project. And I'll say this about him. Of all the musicians that I've ever worked with, they fall in roughly into two types. And one of them is they're going to show you what they can do. And they can play the guitar this way, and they can drum, blah, 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 and they can blah, 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 and so on. And then there's Jim O'Rourke, who listens to what you're doing and finds something that belongs to it, that adds to it, that enhances it. And not just by being, that interesting sound that goes there, too. No, it's like perfect. He's got an incredible facility for finding these things. Plus, he's tough as hell about what he does and what he's prepared to let happen. We have one thing in project right now in the works. I've been working on an opera with that Art and Language wrote the libretto for back in 82. But I've been working on that thing since then. And I've written the music a number of times. I get halfway through and don't like it. Throw it away. Three quarters of the way through, don't like it, throw it away. I've done that a number of times. Well, I finally finished all of the vocal arrangements. At least I got versions of them that I'm prepared to try to go forward from there. And I sent this to Jim in Tokyo and asked him to do the orchestration. So we're collaborating on this opera, Victorine.
Wow.
And I'm waiting for him to send me something. And he tells me he's working on it, so I'm patiently. I sent it to him a year ago, maybe even longer, I don't know. And he takes his time, but sometime it'll come along, something will come out of it. When I first met him, I was with David Grubbs in Chicago. And David said, I know this guitar player, I know this guy's musician, we're going to want you to meet. And I went, and he was like, "Hello, Mr. Thompson," and I was going like, "Please don't, Mr. Thompson." And he, "Oh, okay, Mr. Thompson," and you know. Like,
We wanted to touch on another particular one of your records.
Yeah, and I guess it feeds in just talking about the 90s and Jim O'Rourke years with you. And the finger painting has always been a curiosity of mine, and I wanted to hear more about that.
Finger painting is an interesting problem, isn't it? And that brings us back to O'Rourke, because when we first recorded that, that's an Albert Ullin idea.
Is it? Okay.
Yeah, no, Albert said, why not remake the Parable, Arable Land, and instead of Hurricane and these other tunes, we'll use the tunes that you demoed for international artists, like Mother, Baby in My Baby's Ruth, those tunes that are on there, right?
Yeah.
And the one, simulate some freakouts in between and cut it to be exactly the same times as the Parable album. And the idea always was we'd eventually play these two records side by side, just to see what happened. And we will do this anyway. So we recorded the thing and recorded all this stuff and gave it to O'Rourke to mix. And O'Rourke's mix was finger pointing. Have you heard finger pointing?
I think so. It came with it, right?
There's finger painting and finger pointing.
Okay.
Yeah, well, finger pointing is a single track.
When I heard finger pointing, I thought, God, wait a minute, this is not the idea. And I was impatient because we had this idea, Albert and I were working on this idea, and we thought that there's going to be this kind of thing. And it was only later that I listened to finger pointing in his Jim's mix and realized how good it is, how well it works, and thought to myself, this is even better. Now we got three records we can play at the same time.
So after we're done talking, I could put on those albums simultaneously. And that's an achieve some desired effect. Oh, no, I haven't yet, but I'm planning on it now.
Yeah. So, yeah, finger painting, the idea is that Red Crayola, right? Red Crayola is the first thing they give to you when they want you to stop painting with your fingers, right? Mm-hmm. And so this is Albert Ullin understanding very profoundly all of the relations which might be involved. He is a music freak. He listens to it and knows everything that's going on all the time. He's an amazing fellow. He saves me the trouble in a lot of instances of having to think about anything that anybody else is doing. Not that I'm avoiding anything, it's just I don't always have the energy to get involved in stuff anymore. And don't always hear things that I like. I mean, one keeps making things, these ideas that make sense. This one makes sense, that makes sense. They don't all fit together in any sort of really absolutely coherent way, other than the fact that they all represent ways of playing out the same ideas.
I call my little baby, say let's go to the zoo. Well, how could I know that she wouldn't go unless a purple tiger could come to hide, howdy. Baby, please stay away. You ain't nothing but trouble anyway. How can I keep you around in the state you're in? You baby, bad medicine, baby. Come on, little baby, say let's go to the zoo. How could I know she wouldn't go unless her purple tiger could come to? Howdy. Baby, please stay away. You're nothing but trouble. Anyway.
We haven't made a record in a while, but playing with the Corky Band, I had occasion to think that I thought to myself, I could make one more quote unquote solo album, right? Another, the Corky Redux. And
yeah, circling back.
What happened was I have a very good tape recorder in which I got it hauled out and found out and started looking through my archives and so on and found some tapes that I had, which were work tapes that I was made in 81 when I was starting to play Caribou, playing with Red Crayola and all that and those things. And I was thinking about solo stuff. We're thinking about one more solo record. I had no one really thinking, but just thinking, I would always put down ideas, right? Material. Well, I've got the makings of another solo record. Wow. Very easily. I got a lot of material that I can pass on. But now we have found out that you don't have to all be in the same room to make a record. and to record music. So I think we'll be able to make this stuff long distance. I mean, I think it can be really fun to try to do it that way as well. But that, you know, I mean, I've also gotten to know people in this town. This is an amazing town. This, unfortunately, I've really ended up in a good situation here because I have material on all sorts of platforms, going back all the way to the 60s. And I have DA88 tapes, A-track DA88, digital recorder things. And the machine doesn't work anymore, but there's somebody in this town who's got a machine who can recover those tapes and digitize the information and give it to you back in a file, right?
Yeah.
I said, fantastic. This town is a museum. You can find every, you know, recorder that was ever made. You probably, you can take care of everything.
Yeah.
It's cool. It's a good tech town. Tech town.
You got this hot ensemble too. It seems a shame to not commit them to tape.
No, they are ready for Freddy. Yeah, there's no problem.
Yeah. I think we might be about ready to wrap it up. Thank you for sharing so many great stories and dropping some knowledge.
Yeah.
It's very generous. I appreciate your time and your interest, and wish you all well.
Thanks for listening, my friend. Thanks again to Mayo Thompson for his time and to Jack Habegger and Dylan Shearer for contributing to the conversation. You can find links to Mayo Thompson and the Red Crayola's work on this episode's website at lowprofilepodcast.com. If you'd like to support this project, that's great. The best way to do that is by signing up for flexible monthly donations at patreon.com/lowprofile. We also receive in-kind support from these independent businesses in Olympia: San Francisco Street Bakery, Schwartz's Deli, Rainy Day Records, Old School Pizzeria, and Three Magnets Brewing Company, who also facilitates Shirler Sundays, which is happening in Olympia for the third year in a row. 10 weeks of concerts and onstage interviews with the performers. Oh, and can't forget, Jack Habegger did the illustration for this episode. Keep up the great work, Jack. Love it.
Will the circle be unbroken? Well, by and by, by and by. Will the circle be unbroken? Well, by and by. Well, by and by. Well, I don't know. Damn idea. I heard tell that it would.